My name is Kevin Cahill, and I'm an author. I write books about land ownership in the UK and in Ireland. A lot of the stuff I've written covers the Crown Estate and the Duchy of Cornwall.
Can you give us an idea of some of the disputes there's been over the decades to do with this land holding of the monarch?
Yeah, there is, and there always has been, confusion about what belongs to the Crown or the Queen and what belongs to Prince Charles. There are two reasons for this. The Crown Estate and the Duchy Estate, by and large, don't appear in the land registry. You know, you can't go to the land registry and say to me, show me the land held by the Crown Estate, and you won't get the answer. It's not there.
But, I mean, surely that's the same for quite a lot of land, which hasn't changed hands. The land registry tends to have an index of land as it, I mean, it goes into the land registry as it changes hands. And, of course, a lot of this land has not changed hands for centuries.
And is held by trusts, which, you know, are permanent. In other words, the owner or beneficiary of the trust doesn't change even when somebody dies. So nothing changes in the land registry. So the first problem that was always there is defining what belongs to the Crown and what belongs to the Queen as a person and what belongs to Prince Charles. Now the king.
Well, yes, right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, as I understand it, you've got the Duchy of Cornwall, which is the heir to the throne's property, and you've got all the rest, including the Duchy of Lancaster, which is the Crown Estates, etc., which is the property, so-called property, anyway, of the monarch.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line is that when the coalition government in 2010 came into being, they said, or published a notice saying that the Crown Estate belonged to the Queen. That's the end of it. The Crown Estate is worth about 15 or 16 billion. And the way they got around the problem was the Queen never takes possession. The government managed the Crown Estate. It's like a management contract. You know, you might have, a farm, and you hire a management company to look after it. That's what the government does. It's the manager of the Crown Estates. But the Conservative coalition of 2010 said the Crown Estate belongs to the Queen. So that's clear. But then establishing what land the Crown Estate actually holds and the Duchy of Lancaster holds is extremely difficult and expensive.
For those that actually live on that land, of course, they know they're paying rent to the monarch, and that includes farmers, it includes villagers in cottages, and of course, places like industrial estates, which happen to be on Crown land.
Yeah. But there are all sorts of other hidden privileges that attach to this confused distinction between the government as manager of the estate, like any property. You know, there are loads of ordinary companies that do property management. That is actually all the government does. The ownership is in the Crown Estate, worth 15.7 billion. Is the property of the Queen, and now that she has died, it's the property of the King. So, and that property changed hands without, if you like, any kind of legal process. No will has been published, nothing like that.
I mean, surely that's normal for something that's held in trust. I mean, it's just the trustees that are changing, or maybe the beneficiary that's changing. Anyway, well, what about the, you know, what kind of conditions do the monarchy impose? Because there's been a lot of complaints, actually, about Charles when he was prince. People complaining that actually his rents were incredibly high. I spoke to one farmer who had to leave a tenancy because the rent was so high, and then somebody else came in. After about 2 or 3 years, they had to give up because they simply couldn't make money from a tenanted farm because the rent was so high. In fact, he was known in the area as being charging more per acre for tenanted farms than anyone else.
Yeah, there are issues like this all around the country, especially ones where there's no kind of public access to the Duchy of Cornwall management. You know, if you want to address the management of the Duchy of Cornwall, you're almost forced to use the courts, which is extremely expensive. But there's no proper sort of even semi-democratic participation in the management of the estate.
It doesn't sound like it's very transparent. What about this whole thing of freedom of information?
You almost never get a straight answer. And again, you're into the issue of costs. What the estate, both estates and the Duchy of Lancaster are really doing, they're using cost as a way of stopping people finding out things because it just costs too much time and money. I mean, it took me years. The first book about who owns Britain took me 13 years.
How did you actually get to the facts then?
I found a second doomsday, which had been dropped out of our history. It's not taught in universities or anywhere. In 1872, it was like a deflection shot where I would find a big estate in the past. I would then check local records because, of course, I couldn't get it in the land registry. Although in Scotland, this is worth remembering, in Scotland, some of the Queen's properties are in the Scottish land registry, including the Rockall. You know, the island off the Northern Ireland coast that there's people go and camp on periodically. Well, it's now His Majesty, is the owner of Rockall.
Well, you say an island, it is more like a rock.
Well, there are various agreements that apply to it, which have been put together by the governments of the United Kingdom and the Irish Republic. But there is an issue of precisely where Rockall sits. There's a border dispute. But at the moment, King Charles will now be the owner of Rockall.
Okay, so what do you make of this whole transition between Elizabeth and Charles with the personalities and that sort of thing? We've got the situation, obviously, now with Liz Truss. She has just dropped the green levies on energy in order to try and save the public having to pay them, obviously to try and reduce bills. But, you know, dropping green levies is diametrically opposed to everything that Charles has been working for the last 30 years.
Well, my feeling, and I have a contact who worked with Charles, is that he will, insofar as he's able to, and that's a big question, especially where the government interferes, but insofar as he's able, it looks as if he's going to very strongly pursue his green stuff, green levies. The sort of thing he could do very effectively is plant a lot of trees, because there's certainly enough land to do it. But the hints that are coming out of the palace are that he intends to double up on his efforts.
Well, he can do that on his own land, I mean, which is obviously is just grown in size. What about this head-on collision course with Liz Truss? For example, today they've just announced a resumption of fracking, something that Charles is dead against because of its effect on the environment. Think basic things like the water aquifers getting these chemicals in them and poisoning the water supply.
Well, the company that was the biggest, you know, the first quadrilla, the one that was all for fracking, has actually said fracking doesn't work in the UK. The geology is too fractured and it doesn't work. And that should have always been visible. In North America, there were vast, you know, prairies and all sorts of things. But here, it's an urban country, largely. And you can move almost nothing on scale without affecting, causing small earthquakes. So he's on a good one there. But the other thing, the Guardian have run a series recently on the hidden hand of the monarchy in relation to Acts of Parliament. It's never been declared properly where the Crown says, we have an interest. You know, it hasn't been publicly disclosed. And that
this is Rob Evans, I think, isn't it?
That's right. And that needs to change. And again, I feel that from what we've heard, that Charles A. will up his green agenda and B. would have no trouble saying, fine, you know, if we make an intervention, it shall be public.
Well, this is the extraordinary thing, isn't it, that the Crown has got the right to actually call in a law if it affects the monarchy and alter it before it passes it into law.
Well, where it becomes really sensitive and tricky is when the ownership is uncertain. You know, if a law affects the Crown estate, who does it affect? The manager, which is the government, or the owner, which is the king? You know, there's all this confusion, and the purpose of the confusion in the end is to make sure the ordinary public know nothing and understand nothing.
What do you think is the future for the Crown Estate? And it is massive, isn't it? Do you know how many acres it is altogether?
The Crown Estate, got 145, no, that's the Duchy of Cornwall. The Crown Estate is about 400,000 acres. But again, the measurement of the acres is very imprecise. The Crown Estate owns some of the foreshore, but it's not listed which bits. You know, it's leased off bits to ports, and it's leased off bits to farmers and fishermen and all sorts of things.
Well, it's also the bed of the North Sea and the seabed is starting to lease off now for these wind farms, the tidal up in the north of Scotland, the tidal power system, and, of course, things like North Sea oil.
Yeah, the way leaves, as they call them, that is the rent you pay if you run a cable out to a wind generator, that goes to the Crown Estate. And the Crown Estate is now making extremely serious money out of the way leaves. Again, all this needs to be part of the public discussion.
Well, it is interesting because Charles has been pushing this whole idea of wind farms at sea for a long time, which he stands to personally benefit from.
That is it. You know, who's benefiting? And in a certain kind of crisis, the government could abandon its management of the Crown Estate and give it back to King Charles. Then he would get it all tax-free.
Yeah. So, anyway, what do you make of? Do you think there was a great outpouring of grief, actually, this week for the Queen's funeral? Many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands even, turning out to line the route that the hearse took from central London out to Windsor. And it was quite emotional watching that, to see so many people who seemed to... it's almost as if they weren't just saying goodbye to the Queen, but a whole era, the sort of post-war era, where we'd learnt the lessons from World War II.
Well, she was the big link. And there's no other figure in the world that 4 billion people would turn out to watch. The total total number of viewers for the funeral was 4 billion, half the planet. And there's no figure in politics or anywhere else in the world that would attract that kind of interest. And the interest here at home in the UK felt very personal. You know, there was all the official stuff. But then if you looked at the crowds, they were enormous, especially the crowd going out to Windsor. Extraordinary. I've never seen it. I can remember the Churchill's death, because he had been a cadet, and I was a cadet, and we were kind of ticked off to come and be the escort to the coffin, that sort of thing. And it was huge, but nothing like this. This really did dominate any kind of funeral ever in the UK. It was astonishing.
It's almost that, like, the day after, we've got all these tensions in Ukraine. We've got the Russians saying, well, if you're going to use these long-range missiles that can nearly hit Moscow in Ukraine, supplied by NATO, targeted by NATO, really, you know, basically all the Ukrainian army is doing is just pressing the button. They're not really involved in, you know, making the weapons, supplying the weapons, or targeting the weapons. The Russians are saying, well, you know, if you start using these and you start attacking Russian territory, then you know, we may use nuclear weapons to defend ourselves. So it's almost as if as soon as the Queen is gone, you know, World War II and the legacy of that is out the window, and World War III is on the horizon.
Well, I think it really is important to be very clear about one thing. Nobody has attacked Russia. The attack in law was made by Russia on the Ukraine. The Ukraine is a full member of the UN, and this was one member of the UN, Russia, the Russian Confederation, attacking another member of the UN, which is prohibited by law. You can't do that. So, I mean, the whole Russian position at the moment is based on totally false premises. I mean, Putin claims that the Ukraine is a Nazi state. Well, how do you have a Jewish president of a fascist state? It doesn't work. So the Russian position in law anyway, and in international law, is completely wrong.
Well, what about the opinions of the people? I mean, it's quite clear in Crimea and actually in the Lugansk and Donetsk People's Republic that these people want nothing to do with Kiev, that they're Russian-speaking, and that the Kiev government had even banned the use of the Russian language, you know, this kind of thing. So there was clearly a divide already. These people wanted to secede, a bit like the Catalans or whatever. Or in fact, like the Southern Irish, actually.
There's an element of the same problem. The Crimea in particular, that came into my book because the Crimea, Potemkin grabbed the Crimea in the early 1700s, just as we grabbed Gibraltar, and there was no difference. We were the imperial power in the Mediterranean, Russia was the imperial power on land, and each grabbed whatever it wanted. But the issue of there are substantial Russian populations in all sorts of countries, Lithuania, Latvia, said the Baltic states. And the issue of how Kiev was handling the Russian population is an issue. You know, it should not be airbrushed out or argued away. But don't forget that this was the Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia on the grounds that there were German speakers in this Sudetenland. So this has been done before. But it should have been, what the UN Charter says is you must use peaceful means to resolve this. You can't go to war because you don't like the political color of your neighbor. And, you know, as an old, so the war in Ukraine is fascinating to somebody like me who actually personally had as a friend the man who translated the fascist surrender on the 9th of May in 1945. And we in the West, because of the Cold War, have totally forgotten that the Russians lost 27 million people. We, in World War II, lost under 500,000, Americans about 1 million. But the big, big traumatic losers were Russia and the Ukraine. 6 million Ukrainians were murdered by the fascists, by the Nazis, and 21 million Russians. And we always forget this. It doesn't excuse what Putin has done, quite the opposite. And I think a good deal of the resistance in Russia to the mobilization and everything is coming from people who are saying to each other, but our grandfathers fought together to get rid of the Nazis. Why are we fighting them? A lot of people in Russia, especially military people, are asking why that's happening. But there is you are quite right to point out there's a huge issue about how Kiev handled the Russian minorities. But the key thing is you can't invade just because of that. Not allowed.
Just getting back to the funeral, I wonder whether everything's kind of changed now, is that we've almost, you know, the lessons from World War II have been forgotten. The Queen sort of oversaw that, didn't she? And lived through that generation. She'd lived through the Second World War as well. And it's almost as if now those lessons are gone and forgotten and buried in the vault of St. George's Chapel at Windsor. So the history could be repeating itself.
There is a serious danger, and that's a point that really needs ramming home. She was the last link, the last big link. But King Charles has come in with a lot of goodwill. I mean, his poll standings and everything are substantially up. And that means he's got a mandate to keep doing his green stuff. As you said, with this Liz Truss, how's that going to work? It isn't. She's going to have houses built on agricultural land, and then she's going to give... The Guardian has pointed out this is the most right-wing government we've ever had. The detail isn't there. But this government is using regulation to be, well, you know, no cap on bonuses for the flaming bankers who bankrupted this country in 2008. No, they're there to get a freebie. And people who are on social security are going to have fascist-type regulations imposed on them. You know, they have to work extra hours. There's no question about how do you get extra hours if you're not partly disabled. But this is an attack on the most vulnerable in Britain. And the whole thing, going back to the funeral, the whole thing about the funeral and Charles is that this is a monarchy that is sensitive to what's going on with its people. And Charles has a right to advise the government and to warn the government. And he has stressed this. He's also stressed the fact that the Constitution must be observed. I mean, people are, the media, especially the right-wing media, is whinging about Boris Johnson and Partygate. I mean, come on, guys. This guy lied to the head of state. This guy closed down our parliament unlawfully. Two Supreme Courts nailed him. Boris Johnson is a convicted constitutional gangster. And, you know, why isn't this before the Privileges Committee? You know, people are jumping up and down about lying to parliament. He lied to the head of state. I think that's serious. But I think there are fierce hints in Charles's accession speech and everything that the rule of law would prevail and it would be constitutional law in which the Queen's first or the King's first minister doesn't come in and lie to him. But the right-wing media, remember, we have an excess. The Mail is noisy, shallow, and is vicious, but there's a far worse danger. Earlier this year, President Biden described Rupert Murdoch twice. He described him as the most dangerous man in the world, and he described him as the most destructive man in America. Now, this guy, Murdoch, has free access to Downing Street whenever he likes, apparently. We have no idea why he goes there. No minutes are published at the meetings, nothing. But Murdoch has set his heart on making life impossible for our current king. And we all need to remember that Murdoch has influence at The Sun, The Times, and The Sunday Times, and Sky News. And they will all attack, as they already have, producing stories from history.
Well, hang on a minute, because Sky News has been taken off of Murdoch, hasn't it, by, I think, isn't it, Comcast or Comtel or something in the States, that he's no longer, you know, no longer got a controlling interest in Sky, although he does have
he has shares in Talk TV
now. So, you know, as he gets elbowed out one place, he turns up somewhere else. You know, he's quite, you know, he wants to have a voice, which is understandable. Of course, he's got Sky News Australia, but that's not the same as Sky here in the UK.
No, but as I say, I think the thing is that only The Guardian, and it wasn't in a big, heavily, you know, headline piece, mentioned what Biden said about Murdoch. And nobody said, but this guy calls in Downing Street whenever he likes. Why? I think we should know. Murdoch is absolutely determined to make life as difficult as possible for King Charles.
There's another bit of news this week. That's about the demographic shift in Ireland, in Northern Ireland. Apparently now more Catholics than Protestants. Obviously there are actually more secular people than ever before. So,
yeah,
but they would associate themselves with the, you know, with the nationalist tradition, the Catholics, or the unionist tradition of the Protestants. And there's now more nationalists than unionists, which is a little bit concerning maybe for Westminster. And particularly for Stormont and people like the Ulster Unionists.
Well, I mean, the first thing is that the Unionist majority is now dead, either way. But quite a few Catholics used to vote Unionist, especially prosperous ones. You know, as you went up the social ladder, you tended to side with the local institutions, you know, the powerful institutions. But that has been long... The drift towards a Catholic majority has been, you know, evident for ages in the statistics. But the big excitement in Ireland, which we don't tend to hear much about, is the fact that Sinn Féin are likely to lead the government in the north, and they may very well be the government in the south. So, you know, people need to prepare for that. The Sinn Féin in the polls are the largest party on the island. They have more, you know, people supporting them in the north and the south. And you may have noticed that recently Sinn Féin have been extremely emollient. But they have two very conventional women leaders. Mary Lou MacDonald was Fianna Fáil, and some people think she still is. And Michelle O'Neill in the north seems to be a very cautious and careful person. And she doesn't have the links, the direct links, to Adams and the gunmen.
Finally, on Charles, our new king, the interview which has been effectively banned just before the death of the Queen, done by Martin Bashir, which I don't know if you would agree, I think it's one of the best interviews I've ever seen the BBC do with Princess Diana back in 1995, just before the divorce. In fact, that program spurred the Queen on to write to both Charles and Diana and say, look, it's time, you know, I'm telling you, get a divorce, because this is starting to get messy. And so the divorce happened then after that, and obviously the year after the divorce, the Princess Dinah died in a mysterious car crash. But in that interview, Diana says, uses quite an interesting phrase. She says that the role of king would be too confining for Charles, that he was not fitted for the role. And she said that they had some heated discussions about that wherever the subject came up. And so she's basically saying that Charles wants to change the world, and that actually doesn't fit at all with the role of king.
Yeah, and he has been stressing the constitutional nature of his role since he became king. And that's, you know, in the last 2 weeks, he's really been emphasizing that. It's a bit of a, I mean, Diana didn't like Charles very much, remember?
No, but I mean, she made a very good point there, because he does want to change the world. And yet our constitution seems to suggest that the monarch has got to be apolitical, impartial, etc. Now, he clearly is nothing like that.
No, if he followed his mother, he would be, but he isn't. He is very partial. The thing is, from, if you like, our point of view, he is partial on a lot of things in a positive direction, you know, green stuff and everything. But the issue will be whether he interferes as opposed to advises, and whether he's going to be happy with the role of advisor. The signs so far are yes. But then if we have a government, which it looks as if we have, which disintegrates in the next 3 months, you know, people in Russia are talking about Putin, you know, jailing people for shouting about the war. A somewhat similar tactic is being employed here in the United Kingdom against the poor. If you're poor, you're now going to get hammered. And if Charles called the government's attention to the fact that this isn't how the UK operates, that would be a good thing. So Diana might be proved right, but everything does seem to have changed to me.
Yeah, it does seem, you know, I think in a way that's what the funeral was about. I really, looking back on it, just a few days afterwards, it's like this is something really big has really changed, and everyone was kind of saying goodbye to the old world.
It, in a way it was, and a lot of the green folks, I mean, I have somebody who works with me who did loads of work for Greenpeace and for Charles. You know, he was in Clarence House, and he was a very ordinary person, very ordinary. And still, you know, he was beavering away on Greenpeace issues to do with fishing. So, but then the test of a lot of it will be, well, fine, will Charles put ordinary farmer, you know, tenants on the Duchy Council so that they have a voice? And then you have the same for the Duchy of Lancaster and so on. These little private islands have to stop. They must become part of the mainstream, and the land registry must function. And this thing about if the land hasn't changed hands, there needs to be a land registry that is exactly what the Second Doomsday in 1872 was, a record of owners of land, you know, not trusts and all this sort of stuff.
Look, the property prices are absolutely astronomical. For people to try and get on the property ladder is almost impossible nowadays. And yet, the earth, whatever, you know, perspective you come to, the earth is a free gift to mankind. It's almost as if we have become alienated from the very thing we need from our own survival, Kevin.
Well, you know, the bottom line is there's something else that's as essential as land, and that's water. We get water. Our water bills down here in the southwest are some of the highest in the world, and we got the worst pollution of our rivers. It's done by these people, and they charge us money for it. there's a basic kind of disconnect. We pay for people for the one of the most vital things in life, water, and they turn around and dump sewage in rivers and on the beaches.
Well, I mean, up until the end of the Second World War, there were still tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people that got their water from a well, Kevin, for free.
Yep. I lived in the village where we did. We had a pump, and you went up to the pump in the morning and you filled your bucket or your kettle. Yes, I remember that personally. But
now the situation now, sorry to interrupt you, but the situation now is if you've got enough money, you can buy shares in your local water company and the dividends will pay the bill, so you never actually pay a bill.
Yep, and the dividends are enormous. And the salaries are obscene. If the people did their job, you might be able to justify it, but they don't. There were 300,000, more than 300,000, sewage pollution incidents last year. And, the government's busy beating up poor people and hammering them, and it's not hammering these people.
The amazing thing about the legacy of privatisation, Thatcher and all that, was not only incidents like the Camelford Water disaster, where the first week that the privatisation people took over, they poisoned and to death many people in this
Camelford.
Village in Cornwall.
Yeah.
I think it's in Cornwall.
Camelford.
Is the fact that if you're poor, you're basically paying for the rich's water.
And conversely, you're also paying for unsafe water. You know, the end of all this billions paid to shareholders isn't safe water. It's contaminated water. You know, you followed the Hillsborough disaster, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It took 25 years. For the truth to come out, and the government rigidly blocked every attempt by anybody to have the people responsible and to stop blaming the fans. Our government has a completely mistaken notion of what its job is. And for instance, it's too close to the Crown Estate. It's got too big an interest in it to actually straighten out the Crown Estate and make it, put it in the land registry, show all the bits of it so that people can see what land is around. But the price, there's an artificial market in houses in Britain, and that's at the bottom of it. It's not a lack of land as such, but it would help if we knew where the land was and who owned it, but we don't.
Kevin, whereabouts can people get your books, or which can you just run us through the books that you've done on, particularly on land on Shipping Island and England and elsewhere?
Most of them are now on Amazon, but three of them are the one that's in print and currently selling is Who Owns Ireland, and that's available Amazon.uk and other good booksellers, and. But Who Owns the World and Who Owns Britain and Ireland are out of print. But you can get them, and the prices are quite reasonable.
So yeah,
even I can afford to buy the odd one.
Okay. All right, Kevin Carhill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony. Great.
Thanks for your time, Kevin.
Cheers. Bye,
All right,
Tony.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.